That's Lindinas. And the legend is that the white dragon and the red dragon, as in the red dragon that's on the Welsh flag, fought on that bit up there. And basically they fought and the red dragon won, obviously, and the white dragon is now at the bottom of the lake, and that's why the red dragon is on the flag, in theory. So so basically you can see the bottom of the lake there, and then can you see that kind of ridge line rising up to the left? That is basically Llandy's boundary. So the ridge line, if you follow it all the way along up the top there, that's all Llandy Mountain, basically. That's the kind of mountain heathland until you get to that final peak there, and there's a dry stone wall running down. So that's my boundary with next door, basically. And then, from the bottom of the lake, so all that kind of, that's all the boggy mire around there. So that gets a little bit of quite light grazing by the cattle, really. All the woodland here, sort of rising up from the boggy part, that's all a special area of conservation. So that's part of the Meirionnydd Oakwoods. So it's kind of, it's almost the most northern point of the Oakwoods. So it comes all the way from Dogella. And I think it's an SSE because of the lesser horseshoe bats and all the mosses and lichens that I like. And then you've got the Frith. I don't know what... So in Frith, right. So Danwal, basically, is what we would call it. So above the wall is what you'd call the mountain.
Yeah.
And below the wall, Danwal, is Frith. And it's basically the thing in between the mountain and in between your lower improved ground.
Yep.
Right.
And it's kind of, it's this stuff, can you hear behind us?
Okay.
It's like rough, it was acid grassland, kind of rough grazing, basically. Yeah. It's not improved or anything. And you've got a bit of, you know, kind of a bit of woodland coming into it, and heather and bracken, and then grazing as well. So that's kind of our rough grazing. And then the very green fields is my four small improved fields that kind of everything hinges on. So they, that's all my winter forage, that's my lambing time, that's my fattening. So yeah, the farm's quite heavily reliant on those four fields, really. So but yeah, that's my mix, my very big mix.
I can only say to our poor listeners that the downside of podcasts is that you just can't see the view that we're looking at right now.
What does,
it's just stunning.
What does Llandy Fas mean?
So Llandy literally translates to Black Lake, Lower Black Lake.
Yeah.
But not really, because the Llandy, the D part, is spelt D-Y, which isn't actually black. So... I don't know, in short.
Red Pole.
Oh, well done. Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Machine gun. Sounds like a machine gun.
Ah, right.
Sorry, little avian interlude there.
Good morning, everybody. This is a special episode of Meet the Farmers and the Wild Voices Project. I've always wanted to say that.
Well, now you can.
I can't believe...
Are we actually recording?
Okay. I can't believe I'm actually on the Wild Voices Project.
And I can't believe I'm on Meet the Farmers.
So, Matt, tell me where we're going today.
So, we are off to meet Tulare Fielden, a young farmer recently featured on BBC's The Snowdonia Shepherdess, who runs a National Trust farm in West Wales, Northwest Wales. And Tulare was the winner of the Welsh Young Farmers and National Trust scholarship to run this farm and gain skills as a young farmer. Previous scholars have been based there for 13 months, but I believe I'm right in saying, and we'll find out when we get there, that Tulare is the first young farmer who's been awarded the scholarship to spend 3 years on the farm to give her longer to get to know the farm and to build up more skills as well, which I think the idea behind extending it is to benefit both the young scholar and the farm itself as well. So yeah, we're off to meet Tulare and record a joint episode of Meet the Farmers and the Wild Voices Project podcasts.
Tell me about the Wild Voices Project.
About the podcast?
Yes.
The Wild Voices Project podcast, as he navigates around about, is a podcast that tells the stories of the people saving nature in all sorts of different ways, from campaigning to on-the-ground conservation, to writing, to art, lots and lots of different things, and it aims to do three things: tell the inspiring stories of people doing that, touch on current environmental and conservation issues, and tease out the tips, tactics, and strategies of people who've been really successful in their field, so as you can learn from them and emulate them. It's quite early in the morning, sorry.
Well, that was, I was going to say, that was incredibly eloquent for 5 o'clock in the morning. Very impressive. And why and when did you start it?
I started the podcast 2.5 years ago.
Wow, was it that long ago?
Yeah, I think it was April 2016.
I think Meet the Farmers is like, it's about the same age.
Started off quite slowly and have really ramped it up in the past year and a half. It started as a kind of loose idea about creating a profile and a platform for people who normally wouldn't have that, and I think on the whole it largely still does that. A lot of the guests on the podcast are people you might not normally hear from. And what format it was going to take was fairly fluid, and I was discussing the idea with a friend and eventually rejigged it a few times and settled on a podcast called The Wild Voices Project. And I think I'm around a time of recording getting up on for 50 published episodes, and I've got a few stored up in the vault, so to speak, that I need to edit and publish as well. And you can subscribe on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can find it at wildvoicesproject.org and wildvoicesproj on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to episode 26 of Meet the Farmers, which is a particularly special programme for two reasons. Firstly, we're recording today in the absolutely stunning Snowdonia National Park in Wales. And secondly, excitingly, this is a joint podcast with Matt Williams from the Wild Voices Project podcast, which I urge you all to add to your list of podcasts to check out. Our guest today is Tulare Fielden, a first-generation farmer who won a National Trust scholarship to run the farm here at...
Go on.
Now, we're going to say this a lot today, so I need to get it right.
I felt like I figured it out last night.
Is it, yeah, Clydnu
Isaf.
No? Yes?
Sundi Isaf.
Clydnu Isaf.
Clydnu Isaf.
Clydnu
Isaf.
Clydnu Isaf. Not bad.
Okay. Our guest today is Tulare Fielden, a first-generation farmer who won a National Trust scholarship to run the farm here at Clydnu Isaf, a hill farm in the heart of Snowdonia. She read geography at Aberystwyth University, and then after graduating, she flew to California for 4 months of voluntary work with a food policy council, which I will talk about a bit maybe. After which, she moved back to Wales and then France, where she was given the opportunity to share
farm. That says where she skied for a season.
It does say that. Which we were going to pass over, but yeah, where she did a ski season.
Have some fun. Just,
I was going to say. But was she also given the opportunity to share farm, but felt she wanted to return to her Welsh roots, coming back to a marketing role with the Farmers Union of Wales, and then winning the scholarship to farm here. That's a very whistle-stop tour of your life so far. But thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Yeah, thank you.
It's brilliant to be here, despite the immensely long journey from Essex.
Yeah,
it was totally worth it.
I'm glad it's not raining for you, actually, because it was supposed to chuck it down today. I thought, they're going to appear and think, it always rains in Wales. But it doesn't. It really doesn't.
So we're going to kick off with a question that I usually ask at the top of my podcasts, which is, where did your interest, passion, choose whatever word you want, for the outdoors, nature, conservation, the environment, first begin?
Okay. Well, my granddad, my Tide, he used to farm. And so a lot of our weekends or holidays were spent on just sort of probably getting in the way and playing in the farm, really. And then we've always been quite an outdoorsy family anyway. So we're always kind of walking. And then I've always had very badly behaved ponies as well. So tended to be, every morning before school, we'd always sort of cycle down and do the mucking out. And yeah, so it was always very much a kind of outdoorsy growing up, and then the farming definitely came from my Tide, from my granddad wanting to follow in his footsteps, really.
Did you help out on his farm growing up?
I don't think helping out would be how he would describe it. He sold the farm when I was 10, so anything I was doing before then was very much pottering around, really. But yeah, and he was very interested in woodlands, actually. So when he sold the farm, he kept some land back and planted it up with ash trees mostly. So he's always been quite interested in the conservation side of farming as well. So yeah, I guess that might have rubbed off a little bit.
And at what age did your aspiration to move into farming yourself or become a farmer begin?
Well, I don't remember this, but according to Mum, when I was 4 years old, my tide had given me an old John Deere waistcoat, which I just thought was the bee's knees. And I put that on, and at the time, we were living in a two up, two down in Wrexham. And I announced that I wanted to be a lady farmer, whatever a lady farmer is. So yeah, it started quite young, and then it sort of progressed from there. Really, I sort of went off on different tacks. Sort of got quite interested in more the animal side and more the environmental side. And then during university, got really interested in food policy, and it just kept bringing me back to farming. Really, it was always so tied into everything. So.
Did you ever read the Sophie Stories by Dickens Smith?
That is where Lady Farmer came from.
Yes, exactly.
And I literally had, you know, she had a little piggy bank that said, please donate generously to her farm pot, basically. I had one of those piggy banks that I was saving up for a farm in. So, Brilliant. Yeah, totally Dick Kingsmith, Sophie's Stories.
Before we delve in deeper to the, can you give us some context of the surrounding area here and the farm itself?
Yeah, sure. So the farm itself is a 600-acre hill farm. We're not actually incredibly high, although it feels it, because we're surrounded by, well, Snowdon and Moyle Head Bog. And,
yeah.
Actually, the foot of the farm is basically the lake, Llyn Dinas. So that's literally 55 metres above sea level. It's not very high at all. And then it goes right up to Moyle Dy Newydd, which is 350 metres. It's a real mix. So there's 400 acres of sort of, how would you even describe it? Heathland, shall we say. Pretty mixed kind of, there's quite a lot of woodland regeneration happening there now. There's a lot of heathers, a lot of bracken. It's an absolute bugger to walk through, but it's an amazing place. And then we've got acid grassland, we've got native woodland here, we've got the lake, we've got a lot of boggy sort of wet pastures and mire, and then about four fields of improved grazing. So it's a very, very mixed, albeit beautiful, farm.
We've driven here this morning and driven through the beautiful kind of surrounding landscape and national park. How does it feel to live and work in a landscape like this?
It is amazing. I was saying before, you sometimes when you get so engrossed in your work and you're here every day, you don't think about it. You're just, oh, you know, I need to do this and that to that. And then you sort of, suddenly you'll stop or you'll be somewhere or you'll need to wait for someone and you just look around and go, whoa, this is actually where I'm living now. It's definitely got its challenges, this sort of terrain and the weather and the winter, etc. So I think you see the beauty in a different way when you're living in it and when you really get to know the place. It's maybe not such a, maybe when I moved here it was very idyllic, whereas now maybe I love it warts and all, I think. So yeah,
I mean, you've lived in several different, I'm gonna say several different landscapes
yeah,
actually, but Wales brought you back.
Definitely.
We were talking in the car maybe a bit ethereally about hefting.
Yes.
And stock being hefted to a particular area. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's the same with people as well?
Possibly, because I
was thinking about my own journey sort of going back to Essex as well, yeah, and having a real affinity with that landscape. I'm guessing that you have the same here.
Yeah, definitely. I think possibly my heft is a bit more general in terms of its, because I'm not growing up on a farm, there's not one certain place or one certain farm for me. It's farming in general. And obviously, yeah, I worked in other places farming, but I think for me, my heft would be kind of the Wales agricultural community in general. It was that I wanted to come back to, more than the landscape, to be honest. I sort of found, I loved France, but I think here, you know, with Young Farmers Club and you've got the union and you've got, there's such a community feel, there's such a lot of time that people put into those community efforts, and you're so reliant on your neighbours and you're so dependent on them, that that's what I really missed in France, and I felt like they didn't have it as well established as we do here.
How do you feel like over the past, you've been here for Clindy
Sam?
Esaf.
Yeah, you got it.
You've been here at Hindu Esaf. Have I got that right?
Ish. We'll gloss over it.
Okay, we'll gloss over that. For a year, a year or so, have you found it? Do you feel like you've begun to integrate into the local community over that time?
I've definitely. I was lucky in that I used to do stuff with Young Farmers Club and the Farmers Union of Wales a lot anyway. So I had a few links already, but I've definitely. So I'm now the. I don't know what it is in English. Isad Wainiv. I'm now the deputy leader. I don't know if that translates properly, of our local YFC. Uh-huh. I sit on some policy sort of union meetings here as well. And there's various things that sort of, help steward at things. And definitely in terms of, I can kind of go to the mart now and kind of do the rounds and have a cup of tea with people, which is really nice. There's plenty of teasing that you get at the beginning. And I definitely feel like I've definitely tried anyway to become part of it, so...
And how does that connection with the local community play out in your day-to-day job?
So a lot of it, in terms of sort of the hill farm side of things, all the gathering, the big days, you have to do them as a group. There's just no way that one person is going to gather all of Snowdon by themselves. The sheep will just run circles around them. So it's very much a community effort in terms of everyone locally, and some extras will come in. Everyone will have their place on the mountain, and it'll be one massive day of gathering or dipping or sorting. So that's very much, and also the other side of it is that quite regularly sheep will wander. So you need to have very good relationships with your neighbours, who will then ring you up and go, I've got some sheep for you again. They're in the pen. Or even, when you're actually... getting to know people well, when they'll actually bring them back for you. You're very much reliant on them for the big days as well as the everyday work. And for me, so Havel y Llan, which is another National Trust farm over the road, I'm there most days and I'm very much part of that team. And also I ask them for help a lot. just for certain things that you do struggle to do as one single person. So,
And you mentioned our chat before we started recording that Welsh speaking is quite important in this part of the world.
Yeah, definitely. Particularly, to be honest, within the agricultural community, Welsh is very much the main language here, and I think it varies. Within agriculture in Wales, it's a higher percentage that speak Welsh anyway, so it's about a third. Whereas somewhere like this, probably within the agricultural community, it's more like 90% will speak Welsh. And it's very much the kind of living, everyday language of farming here. That's definitely been a really important part of me probably finding it quite easy to integrate here and be one of the boys.
Sorry, I know this isn't on the quote, but can you give us some Welsh terms, or some Welsh farming terms?
Okay.
I'm just really interested.
So flock is the adell. So my diadell, devaid is sheep. Think of some others that you like.
What about things like there are dialects for say yow or?
Yes, so that's one that I've learned since I've been here. So tup or ram here, they say maharan, whereas where I'm from in Mid Wales, we'd say hurf. So that's changed, and then mogal. So ewes, I would just say devide at home, whereas here they say mamogai.
Okay.
So that's quite, and there's different, so I'd learnt those, fattening.
What about a hog?
Pesky. Hespin.
Interesting.
Or more than one, spinod. Yeah, right. To be honest, those are ones that I'd learnt since coming here, because I hadn't really used that with those before, so yeah, definitely.
Interesting. Your turn.
Not to do more pronunciation in Welsh, given my efforts so far. I noticed that you said it helps you to be one of the boys. Is it a male-dominated community here? Is that a factor that comes into play for you being a woman in a sector that I guess might be still dominated by men?
Yeah, I mean, I think possibly particularly so, I'm not sure why, but within upland hill farming, I've found it more than at home, which is more within kind of dairying or poultry or cattle, that I feel like there's more girls that I know at home, whereas definitely if you're in the market, I don't know what the ratio would be, it's probably kind of 30-40 to 1 sort of thing. It's very much in the market it is but saying that, within sort of the wider agricultural community in terms of your consultants or policy work or jobs like that, it's more mixed. I think it just seems to be more in the, I don't know, it's the everyday farming itself, I'm not sure. But yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I work with 10 men at Abclan, so yeah, I'd definitely say I'm in a minority. But
so we've spoken about your granddad already. Were there any other people who were inspirations to you or mentors to you, whether you knew them or whether you, you know, saw them from afar?
I think once I went to, when I went to France, so I initially just started out on a farm there, woofing. So yeah, you know what that means.
Willing workers on organic farms. There we go. Worldwide opportunities on organic farms. I can't that's remember the one which I one knew. It is now.
Yeah, I don't know. But because sometimes when I say that, people go, what? Sorry. So, and I only started out there just as a, yeah, as a woofer for a month. But the woman who ran the farm there, Mart, Kylie Worthington, was just an amazing role model. She was really tough and she was tough on me, but it was kind of her pushing me that made me stay on there a little bit longer, consider the share farming. And I think just seeing her being, it was her who ran the farm. It was her who very much sort of went, no, you can do this. Come on. And so having that kind of maybe female role model really helped. And she just wouldn't take no for an answer. If I'd say, oh, I'm finding that quite hard. She's like, no, come on. And she really pushed me in terms of, she'd always ask me, well, why are you doing that? Why do you think? You know, it wasn't an education just in do that, do this, or this is how it works. It was, why do you think you do this? And her way of living, very much conservation, was such an important part to her way of farming. And she very much saw the two as being completely integrated and dependent on each other. So that was really, I think, seeing that working in a practical sense, being on a farm that did that, but also being with that sort of person, really definitely inspired me. Yeah, so my tide and Mark probably quite a lot.
I want to go through some of the highs and lows of your time here so far. Perhaps let's focus on the lows, because they tend to be more memorable and more. What is, and actually, I mean, this is one of Matt's questions actually, but I want to focus on, yeah. It's, yeah, what is a failure that you've learned important lessons from for the future?
many failures. I think I definitely had a tough lambing. And
so that was another one of my questions,
really. Yeah, no, it was, and partly that was partly the weather, in that it was such a late season, the grass just didn't really seem to come through. I'd also never really lambed outdoors before, and basically I either didn't spot the signs too quickly or what, but some of mine went down with magnesium deficiency. But because once I'd found them, and they were, it was quite a sudden death after that, the vet then thought it might be looping ill from ticks, and so I didn't feed them. I didn't give them enough supplementary feed, basically. And I think basically what I'd also done was, sorry, it's getting a bit technical now, but I'd muck spread a bit late in the season before they come back, and then we had a sort of flush of grass. They obviously chomped away at the grass. It didn't really pull up any of the good stuff, i.e. the magnesium. And so that's definitely a lesson learned, quite a hard lesson learned. Obviously, there's things that are out of your control in terms of the weather and foxes, etc. But that was definitely one thing where I know now. and I think you feel it harder within farming, because you don't get, it's not a quick fix off the time. You have to wait another year. and then obviously you've got the responsibility of the animals as well. So I think that, combined with then the weather and you're tired and then you've done something wrong, that can be pretty heartbreaking.
What are some of the other challenges of farming stock in this landscape?
One thing is definitely just the amount that they can wander off. So I have been astounded by how high sheep can jump. And I think because Sunday, basically I think the sheep that stayed on here after they got sold, there wasn't many of them. And so we're kind of having to reheft them here to Sunday. And then one of the other scholars didn't keep any ewe lambs on, and then one of them sold quite a lot, and then I've bought some new ones in. So we are kind of trying to reheft them, and so they will just wander. And when you're one person and a dog and you don't know the place, trying to get one or two sheep in off the edge of a mountainside, you know, somewhere that you can't get a quad. And that's been really hard, and that's where I've really had to rely on having a clan and my neighbours. Can you come help me today? I've got a load of sheep. God knows where they've gone now. And so that's definitely been challenging, just within this sort of terrain as well, and especially with a young dog. That's been quite hard. So
you were saying before we started recording about how now that the scholarship is 3 years long, it gives you the chance to reapply some of the lessons that you've learned from the first year in the, you know, in the next 12 months and in the year after that as well. So, you know, despite those failures or mistakes or setbacks, things that are out of your control, you must feel in a good position to, you know, now apply those lessons to the coming 12 months.
Definitely. And that's been a really nice part of having it extended, because I already feel, so we're in November now, so I've done sort of a year and 2 months, and I literally feel just doing things the second time round. You know, as an example, this last couple of weeks, it's been really busy at having a clan. There's been a lot of sheep sorting to do. Well, I've actually been helpful instead of being a pain. You know, I've been able to get in the trailer and take them places, and I've been, you know, because I've passed my trailer test, I've been able to actually sort of handle them. The dog's been there with me, and we've actually done some good, useful work for once. And so, yeah, just being able to be more helpful. I can do things by myself a lot more. Previously I was very much having to rely on them to come help me move the cows, and it's nice. I can actually see what's worked and what's not this year, and make a few more, you know, trial a few different things. So yeah, it's really exciting. And you do, I mean, you'll know, you end up living and breathing the farm, don't you? Like, it's just, it becomes the main thing that you think about, and you're like, right, well, we could try this, or maybe we could do this, or maybe that will work. And I do feel now that I live and breathe.
With that in mind, though, how do you find the time, and do you find the time to shut off?
No. No. My family and boyfriend get very frustrated at me because it's all I talk about. And if I'm not talking about that, I'm talking about some kind of really boring, like, Brexit food policy or something. So, no, I'm not very good at that, because in the evenings, sort of, you know, there'll be YFC, or I'll work late, or I'll go to a committee meeting, or I'll watch Fermio or Country Fine or something. So, no, I do struggle a little bit. But one thing that I've done a little bit is sometimes I'll go home for a day, and that doesn't really shut me off either, because I've got some sheep there. But in the evening, Mum will be like, right, we're in. Glass of wine, vinyl on, let's talk about... And literally, we put a farming ban on our conversation. So that's the only way to do it, really.
Shifting slightly to the wildlife side for the Wild Voices Project bit of the podcast, are there any kind of memorable encounters with wildlife, or maybe just memorable moments, you know, in the landscape that you've had over the past year or so?
Oh, there's definitely been a lot, I think, because Sunday is, I mean, the wildlife here is amazing. And I'm trying to think of a specific example, but there was one where my uncle came up to watch, and he's quite a, do you call them twitchers? When they watch birds a lot. Is that the word?
Twitch is quite,
sorry.
Oh, is it? Oh, no, I'm just
looking at that space. And what's the difference between a bird and a twitcher? For the benefit of
Oh, no.
Sorry.
So birder is quite general. Twitch is pretty specific. Twitcher is like, I'm going to drive 200 miles to see this rare bird that I've just heard about, pull a sickie, get there, see it, leave.
Oh,
that's twitching.
Oh, okay.
You get kind of twitchy when there's an
exciting
bird. About
it. Well, do you know what? I think I might have used it. He's going to kill me now. I think I've used it in the right context,
okay.
Because my uncle is, he would do that. And he lives up in Ilkley in Yorkshire, and came here to try and see a hen harrier.
Okay.
And I said, oh, I've only seen one, and it was over Gelliaga way. It wasn't here. I'm not sure you'll see one. The weather was a bit rubbish, blah, blah, blah. And he literally got here, and I was just pointing out a few things on the farm. He turned around and went, oh, there's one there. And it was just all that build-up. Yeah. And I think he was expecting to sit here with a scope for, like, days. And it was just there. It was just above my house. It was amazing. So, yeah, sort of little sort of surprise moments like that. And then I didn't know what a woodcock was before I came here until I literally nearly stood on one. Walking down by the lake. And it was just an evening walk. And I had Roy with me. Sort of dusk. And it's very down by the lake. It's sort of quite boggy mire. It's quite... the rushes are quite high, and we were just walking along, and all of a sudden, sort of, it just sort of flew out at me. Oh, what was that? And then I went back with someone, and they said, "Oh yeah, no, it's a woodcock." So I wasn't sure what its beak was. But just in general, to be honest, and seeing kind of the changing seasons here, like the autumn's been absolutely beautiful here.
Amazing.
Oh, just incredible. And what I've enjoyed here that I've not really seen in other places that I've worked. It sounds a bit sad now, but the mosses and the lichens here are amazing.
Brilliant.
They're literally just, yeah. Like, you go through the woods and you feel like you're almost in some kind of weird, damp jungle.
Yeah.
And it's quite, yeah, the woodland here is it's amazing. And you can almost, it almost feels different when you walk into
temperate
it.
Temperate rainforests,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 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 And it's just amazing. And that's not really sort of the farm that I was at in France. It has a lot of similarities to this, but it didn't have that kind of humid, damp... the mosses are just amazing. So.
You know, this isn't just any farm, it's a National Trust farm. What's different about farming on a National Trust farm and on a farm that's owned by that much larger and historic institution?
Mm. So I've got, just in terms of the practical everydays, we've got we've got the agri-environment scheme, which is obviously just part of, obviously that's government run, but then we've also got layered on top of that, the sort of National Trust management plan for here. So it kind of goes above and beyond in terms of the conservation side, and especially with Llyndy, which is very much run, obviously we're trying to get the balance, but at the same time, it's very much nature's at the forefront in a way. The farming side is the main way we achieve a lot of that, and mm-hmm. it's obviously a working farm, but I think it's given an even higher priority. It's nice to be somewhere where that is that's the goal, that's the aim, that's where you get, you know, the support is there to farm in that way. And it's such a special place for that anyway. You know, when they got the farm through the appeal, it was already in a very good place in terms of nature and wildlife as it is. So it's just being able to kind of not just sit back and go, oh, lovely, this is great for wildlife. It's being able to go, right, what else can we do? What more can we do? Let's find some more, you know, more, oh, what are they? CPIs, conservation.
Performance indicators.
Those, yeah, that's the one. so yeah, it's sort of an extra interest to it, really, you know, instead of, it definitely affects the everyday work on the farm as well. So you do have to sort of weigh up your priorities and change things about. So, and it definitely, you know, you can see it in the place. There's still work to be done, but it's looking pretty good.
What are some examples of the ways that you use the farming to achieve those conservation outcomes for wildlife or for habitats?
So the main thing, to be honest, is the grazing.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to sort of sum up a lot of spreadsheets and management plans, the basic gist of it is that we use low densities of cattle or sheep, low stocking densities, to basically kind of maintain a nice mosaic of habitat. So we're not trying to go, right, let's hammer this part, let's leave that part. So a little bit of grazing here and there means, as an example, on the mountain in the summer, that gets grazed by cattle and sheep. But there's still areas that won't actually be grazed that summer. There'll be areas that will be left because the stocking density is so low.
Mm.
And in the winter, we pull them off because if they stay on there during the winter, they'll be grazing out kind of the shrubs, the heather, the bilberry maybe. So it gets rest, but it also gets enough grazing so that we don't just get a sudden flurry of bracken, or there's not just one thing that comes.
Yeah.
There's a mix of things. So some bits get left more open, some gets left otherwise. So definitely.
So just to kind of elaborate for people, what's the problem, or why is it a problem if you get a big flush of, say, like bracken, for example?
Sure. So a lot of it is just to do with diversity. So in some places where the grazing was very much based on sheep production, so you've got, obviously what you want for that is certain types of grasses. So that's what happened, which is fine. But then to counteract that, they then went, right, no, we need no sheep at all. And they pulled all the sheep off there, and all you got was one thing that came instead of it.
Mm.
So you either get just longer, ranker grasses coming in its way, or areas like this, you just get bracken. And actually, that's not really good for anything, because it's just one different type of monoculture, basically.
Yeah.
So instead, keeping that kind of mix of things, grazing a few things out. The cattle are really good for kind of trampling through the bracken. The sheep will keep some bits really open. So you just get that mix of habitats then that then helps everything else come in its place.
I think what you've described is quite interesting, because we were chatting in the car again on the way over about how particularly sheep seem to be quite a polarizing topic in conservation. And, you know, at one extreme, you've got them described as, quote unquote, you know, a white plague. And at the other extreme, there's people who defend sheep farming really, really vehemently.
Yeah.
And actually, what you've described is something a lot more nuanced, which I think debates of a lot, you know, of many different issues need a bit more of, is more of the nuance and what's in the middle.
Definitely. And I think to be honest, I think that is a perfect example of the culture change that needs to happen on both sides.
Mm.
The reason that we had a lot of sheep on the hills was because the emphasis was on productivity after Second World War. That's what was paid to do. That's what we were trying to do. So that's what happened. That's not bad or good, or that was the aim. The aim was sheep. Whereas now we want a few different things for the mountains, so it's starting to change. But the fact that maybe on the more conservation side they will say, you know, sheep scoured hills, and then on us, on the farming side, we say, well, no, we've got to have sheep. You know, it's just a culture shift, and there just needs to be more of that middle game. And basically, all it ends up being to do with is, what are you trying to gain from the hills? It's nothing to do with sheep being bad, sheep being good. It's just your management, and it's what you're trying to do with the place.
We first met at Country of Our Live, and you know, you've done the BBC show as well. Do you see the public platform and public profile that you have as a way to bring out some of those slightly more reasoned and nuanced lines of argument or discussion that are needed in what at the moment is, in many places, quite a polarised debate?
Yeah. Ooh. I don't know if I have a public platform. Yeah, I'd like to think so. I think it can be easy, to be honest, when you're in the everyday kind of slog or hard work of things. I find it sometimes hard to then go, right, I'm going to sit on Twitter and have a debate with someone. Sort of as an example, the other day, my mum was saying, oh, you've got to ring in. There was something on Jeremy Vine about the meat tax, where they bandied all red meat as one thing. Every single type of meat, just as one thing, which was bad. You've got to ring in. But I was just on my way back from the market. I'd had a bit of a rubbish price. I had loads of stuff to do. And I just knew if I'd have rung up, I'd have been the angry farmer. I'd have just been, you know. And so sometimes it can be hard to make yourself have that debate with maybe... And in your mind, you're thinking, they're not going to agree with me. We're not going to find a middle ground. But definitely, I think it's really important that we as farmers and conservationists have more of that discussion. And sometimes I don't think Twitter's the best place for it, because you publicly don't want to be seen to back down.
Yeah.
I have much more productive chats with people one-on-one in the pub, on the farm. To be honest, if you get them out here to see the place, they may have been ranting at you about sheep scoured hills, and then you bring them here and you show them the sort of things that you're doing. And a lot of it, on both sides, it's just lack of understanding or knowledge of kind of the reality of both sides.
I should say, after doing both our podcasts, you definitely have a public platform.
Oh.
Absolutely. Thousands of people.
I'll get back on Twitter.
No, it's pretty amazing what you've done here, but we have to admit that you're not the only star of the show here. I really want to talk about Roy.
He's the main man.
Yeah. Was he easy to train? Roy, for those who don't know, is Delaney's sheepdog.
Yeah, he's a star. So I bought him because I knew I was coming here, and I knew that I wasn't particularly experienced or knowledgeable. I needed a dog who had done a bit already. He's still very young, but he had his basic training. So he could do combine, he could away, and he could sort of do stand, although enthusiasm tended to take over sometimes. But it's been a different challenge here, because he's been trained in small fields, small flock of sheep, not ones that are going to suddenly leap over a mountain wall, not ones that need to be driven down a mountain away from you. So that's been a really steep learning curve for both of us, really. And that's definitely been, I think, where I've had my most tears, but also my most joy, is just training him. And also getting tips from the people here, because a lot of them have, you know, three, four dogs. they're absolutely brilliant at training and working them. And so working alongside them is equally frustrating because you realise how far behind you are, but also quite inspiring as well. So what frustrated me a bit at the beginning was I would say, oh, you know, you can't do this and this isn't happening and I can't do it. Blah, blah, blah. And what they would always say was, oh, me thou, which means he'll come, it'll happen. Oh, me thou. And I would go, no, tell me how to do it. What exactly do I need to do? Blah, blah, blah. And you know what? He has, me thou, me thoth. He came, it happened. And he is, it's just the work. It's just, lambing really helped. Just having him every day working alongside me. Just clicking with him even more. Getting the stand really good. The lie downs literally only come in the last month, which is useful. and just, yeah, just work. And then also me learning to be more patient, I think. I sort of wanted to be able to do it straight away, and that's just not how it works. So definitely, I think I've been able to sit back a bit myself and go, hold on to Larry, like, what are you doing? What do you need to change? Instead of just getting angry. So
yeah, I know a lot less about this than the two of you. Is I mean, it's obviously not just about the commands. Is some of it about your body cues, your body language?
Yeah, it's supposed to... Well, the trouble is, once you're on a mountain and they can't really see you, once you're in that sort of situation, it's literally just the whistling.
Right.
But definitely when you're in a smaller field, it's very much the body language, especially when you're in the pens as well. And he knows when I'm in a mood as well. He can definitely tell. But we've not actually got the hang of the whistling yet, so that's something that's going to hopefully come in this coming year. So at the moment I'm still yelling at my loudest on a mountain to try and get him to hear me, which is a bit embarrassing. And then a lot of it is sometimes when you're up high, he has to be able to work kind of off his own initiative, because sometimes the wind picks up, he's so far above you that he can't see you, so he needs to learn, where's she trying to get me to bring this sheep? So it's an amazing thing. And the dogs, he's getting there, definitely. But the dogs over at Hamlachan, they are incredible to watch.
I think I read somewhere, which means Ben read somewhere. but this question has my name next to it. That just 3% of farmers in Wales are under 35. The average age is over 60. Why do you think that's the case, and why does that matter?
Oh, it matters a lot, but I think in terms of why it's an issue, part of it now is to do with the fact that a lot of us have gone to uni and maybe come out of uni with an expectation of some certain type of job, a certain wage, certain expectations. And I think farming, there's a lot of amazing kind of jobs within the industry, but the actual day-to-day farming itself, it's hard. It's long hours. It's pretty rubbish pay. and you don't really get a holiday, which is, I think, you do... Well, I think I came out of it as well, thinking those are things that you just expect from a job. And I think, you know, before you always had that... Maybe you were working with your parents and you grew up doing it, and it was that expectation that you were going to take it on. Whereas now I think people are going, well, maybe I can do something a bit different. I do fancy travelling a bit. And I think maybe because there's more opportunities, people are almost less tempted to have to do that long, hard slog in order to get the farm at the end of the day. And it is a hard industry to get into. I think more farmers' sons and daughters are going out of it. And at the same time, I think a lot of people want to farm, but, you know, I found myself, it's a really expensive thing to try and do. You know, land is ridiculously, ludicrously expensive. Tenancies are still quite expensive because you have to pay for stock, you have to pay for machinery. You know, the prices aren't there like they used to be. The subsidies have gone down. Whilst there's so much going for it, and I still think it's the best job in the world, there's a lot of barriers to getting into it. And there's a lot of challenges. And I think a lot of my friends they like the idea of it, and they'll come visit for a weekend and go, oh, look at the cute lamb, or wow, you live in an amazing place, you're outside all the time, amazing. Yeah. Or they'll look at someone's Instagram and go, wow, farming's amazing. And then if they actually come and do the everyday, it's not quite so tempting. I think the everyday stuff it's tough, but I think it's really, really rewarding. But it's definitely a hard thing to get into.
What do you think kept you going when a lot of other, you know, young people would have looked at it and gone, oh, maybe that's not for me, or had a go at it?
obviously a bit mad. I think because I went off and did other things, but wanting to, and I think I did try and do other things, try to have a different career, and I think just when I actually went and did it and just sort of did, you know, a week lambing for someone or went off to France and stuff, there was still, I still loved it despite the hardships. And I think what I find really rewarding is just there's something very physical at the end of your day that you've done. Whereas when you sit, when you're in an office, okay, you've answered so many emails, you've had a meeting, you've achieved these certain things, but you actually, at the end of your day, you've gone, right, well, that's sorted, or I've built that, or that lamb is fatter. and it's very kind of real, it's very physical. And also I think it's the most, this is very, very arrogant, but I think it's the most important job in the world. So I think, you know, you get a lot of satisfaction out of the fact that you're producing food and you're managing an environment. And you can have a very negative effect on them, but you can also have a very positive effect. And so I think there's the everyday slog, but there's also that kind of higher, bigger thing that you're achieving as well.
I completely identify with the looking back at the end of the day and seeing what you've done. You know, I worked on nature reserves for a couple of years, and there's nothing like looking at a piece of land after a day's work on it and thinking, that's the impact that I've made. We haven't asked much actually about your time in California or your marketing stuff that you did as well. What, even if those were a bit different, what skills or lessons did you learn from those roles that perhaps you've brought into farming?
I think in terms of, I don't know how much I brought this in, but when I was in California, so I was working in Oakland, and the sort of the food access there was awful. So you could literally go to a corner shop and very easily pick up what are they called, these like awful kind of very easy ready meals, kind of corn syrup stuffed things. Getting fresh fruit and veg was like nigh on impossible, and it was really expensive, and there was, you know, massive problem with kind of obesity there, and, you know, a lot of people, there was a food bank there. And so seeing that aspect of farming and food was quite kind of, I find it quite hard-hitting. I find it quite sad. Like, I always, you know, food was just a complete given to me, and the fact that you could access it was a complete given. And so I find that really interesting, because you're sitting here producing it, but then you think, well, actually, where is this actually going to go? Is this going to get to people that actually need it? And so I think that's a really important thing to remember when you're farming as well. There's just so much that ties into the food system, and there's so much to fix. There's so much that needs improving. So I found that really interesting. And then the marketing work that I did, again, that was sort of realizing that a lot of it comes down to not the fact that you're producing something to an amazing quality and you're putting your heart and soul into it, and the, you know, it's conservation grazing. A lot of it comes down to how it gets marketed at the end of the day and where it goes. And so I think in the future, I'd like to think that I could direct sell my own produce, because I have got the marketing role, and I think that's where a lot of the stuff that's produced here gets sold kind of a lot less than what it's worth, because as farmers, we're not marketeers, we're not salespeople, and we're not into branding. So it's a very different skill set that we've got. And so I think if the two were tied together more, you would, you know, the stock that I produce here could actually be sold as conservation graze, National Trust, Snowdonia, lamb, you know, and actually go for what it's actually worth, what it actually is, instead of just, you know, going off to the mart and going in with everything else.
What's next for you? I assume you'll be sticking in Wales, and I hope you'll be sticking in farming.
Definitely. So obviously I've got to London for another couple of years. And then, you know, I'm constantly thinking about what I could be doing. A lot of it depends a bit in terms of possibly getting a tenancy. That's still, you know, I still need to have saved some money behind me in order to do that. And I think it would need to be the right kind of tenancy as well. It's hard with farming. You put so much into the farm and the place itself, that even though I think a tenancy is probably the logical next step for me, it's hard as well to think if you're really going to build up a business and kind of do a lot on the conservation side of things as well, it makes more sense for it to be your own in terms of what you're putting into it sometimes. But maybe that's just, you know, an assumption that I have. So I definitely want to keep farming. I do still enjoy, I'm still quite involved on the policy side of things. And I do really enjoy that. And I think it's a really important time to stay engaged in agricultural policy. So possibly I'll keep on with some of that work as well. What I'd really like to do is find a way to be able to direct sell whatever I'm producing. So that's, I think maybe a smaller plot of land might work better so that I can kind of develop. It might be on a smaller scale, but develop that side of things more. And I think round here, you know, there's such a story to be told here. And there's a lot of tourists here. So, and there's a lot of people that, okay, some of them just want to come into the mountains, see how beautiful it is. But a lot of them, when they stop me on the farm, they're genuinely quite interested. You know, how does this work? Why have you got the sheep here? How are you doing that with the dog? And I'd love to be able to do more, not educational side of things, but just kind of engagement. I think it's really important that we do more of that now. I think it's important more than ever that we've got sort of the public on our side. And especially that's going to help us, you know, in terms of payments or subsidies, that's going to help us on the conservation goals as well. You know, at the moment, it doesn't particularly pay to do that type of farming in some respects. And it's so important that we do. So, yeah, it'd be nice to think a little bit more engagement and better policy would help achieve that, really.
Just a few questions left to wrap up with. So one that I often ask in my podcasts is, are there any particular books, maybe films or podcasts that you often recommend to other people?
Oh, okay. That's a good question. So Mark Kylie Worthington, that I worked for in France, she wrote a book. Where is it? I've got it up there somewhere. I think it's called Food First Farming. Mm-hmm. And it's about her definition of ecological agriculture, and that's kind of my Bible. I absolutely love that. I do listen to Farming Today and Costing the Earth quite a lot. Fermio, you can watch it with subtitles, so Monday nights on S4C, and it's also on Catch Up. It's the Welsh farming program. It's on for half an hour, I think it is. Yeah, Fermio. It is brilliant. So it's very much, it tends to do kind of three different stories. And a lot of the sort of farming community around here, if they don't speak Welsh, they will watch it with subtitles. Mm. It's very real, it's very honest, and I do love watching that.
We don't get stuff like that in England.
Yeah, I don't know why. Fermio is brilliant. And there's not, yeah, because there's, what would be the closest thing you've got, Countryfile, I suppose?
Yeah.
Or Garth. It's quite different to Countryfile. Yeah. Quite different. So now I do love that. And then probably a bit of a standard one, but The Shepherd's, is it The Shepherd's Life by James Van Banks?
Yes.
I did love that.
Mm.
That was one of my favourites. Dick Kingsmith. Sophie's Stories inspire some little children to get into farming. Yeah. So
I think Ace was my favourite.
Yeah. Mad one. Yeah.
What are some of the jobs coming up, or maybe some of the changes in the landscape over the winter that you're looking forward to?
Looking forward to winter.
Looking forward to maybe that's not
right phrase. He asked me this one, like, okay, this
year. Looking forward to spring.
Maybe the scenery out of the window.
I was kind of, this month's been a big one in terms of just getting everything sorted. So yeah. I feel I've got a little bit of a tiny breather now. I shouldn't say that, something will happen. So this month's been quite, autumn's really busy, which has been, I've really enjoyed it because I'm really run down, as you can tell from my voice, but it's been a heck of a lot of kind of sorting sheep. There's been a lot of gathering, which has been great because the weather's actually been quite good.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had some really good gathers. Then, a lot of kind of sorting sheep, big days, dipping. The cattle are now in. Well, you need to go hear them later on because they are noisy. So now I'm kind of getting into the sheep. A lot of the sheep are away wintering now. The cattle are in. So now it's my really important time to get a lot of the maintenance jobs done. So I have got dry stone walling to do coming out of my ears, fencing, and then the big job for the winter, which will kind of be enjoyable because it's an amazing view, but the mountain part of Llundy, the the mountain fence needs a lot of work, and that's somewhere where you can't really get to with quad. So it's going to be hard. It's going to be a hard job to do, but it's going to be quite satisfying. So
I'm going to stray from the script and ask a question that's not
written. Uh-oh.
But how do you prioritise between all those different jobs, and how are you like time? Have you got a system for time taking all that?
So I've got a list. It's a bit chaotic. It's on my phone somewhere. But so I've got important/urgent in one box. Then I've got urgent, not important.
Yeah.
Important, not urgent. Mm. And then on the cart, on the books, ad a gwaith. I don't know what that is in English. But and so basically, I just kind of wiggle those around. And I've got a list for. This is really sad. I've got like a 6 month list. I've got a month list. I've got a week list. And then like the night before. My boyfriend really hates this. I'll lie in bed going, I need to do this, and then I need to do that, and then I'm going to do that, and then I make a little list just before I go to sleep. It's really sad. But yeah, just lists. I love lists.
So no, that's really interesting to hear that. Really...
And to be honest, sometimes it never works out that way, because like this morning I got up and I was like, right, I was going to do some things with the sheep. I got up and the cows had escaped. So that was my morning job, you know, list done. Yeah. So something will come up and I'll be over at Haverland for a few days trying to help out. So nothing goes quite to plan, but there's certain things that need to happen by certain times. So.
There's a good farming friend of mine from Somerset. Before I started farming properly, she said, farming is 95% firefighting.
Yes. Yeah, it really is. It really is. Running out this morning. I've got CCTV in the cow shed. I came down and sort of was making myself a cup of tea. I was like, oh, God, I've got quite a nice day ahead of me today. And I peered over the CCTV and I was like, where are the cows? And I don't even know how, but they were wandering down the lane. So, yeah, that was my firefighting for the morning. Definitely.
I think that's kind of the end of our list. Is there anything else that you wanted to say or that you expected us to ask? Or is there anything you want to ask that you thought?
Nothing else for me to add.
This is your time.
This is my, oh dear.
Your message to the world.
Oh no, don't do that. I haven't thought about anything.
The very small world that listens to the world
to meet the
farmers.
Right.
I'm sorry, the very large world. Rapidly expanding world.
Come visit London. Yeah. As long as it isn't a big world that's listening, that would be awkward. I think it's an exciting time for agri. I think it's a really important time to get behind British agriculture, I'll be honest. I think it is quite, with the changes that are coming, it is quite a scary time. There's a lot of uncertainty, especially in terms of trade. So I think, yeah, buy local. Don't be too quick to judge. And also, yeah, I think we should all just need to kind of engage better with each other and hopefully things will improve.
Perfect.
Great. I think that's a great note to end on.
Well, that's it for another episode, folks. Huge thanks to Tulare and Matt for their involvement. It was great to collaborate with the Wild Voices project, and I hope we can do some more joint episodes in the future. I'm Ben Eagle, and this has been a joint Meet the Farmers Wild Voices project podcast. I've been working with Matt Williams, who you can find on Twitter at Wild Voices Proj. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Benji_Eagle, and please do get in touch if you have any feedback. You can find my contact details at thinkingcountry.com. I'll see you next time on Meet the Farmers.